You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We will explore how a neuroscientist is untangling how our brains negotiate the physical world through words and how we know what we know. Do you play Wordle? Maybe do crosswords? Study a new language? Play piano? What do you think goes on inside your brain? Join in on the brain, 800-642-1234. But first, this week, WPR is marking 2 years of the pandemic in Wisconsin with stories about how COVID has changed us in lasting ways. Beginning in March 2020, healthcare workers were lauded as heroes. But as Bridget Bowden reports, 2 years into the pandemic, burnout in the healthcare field is higher than ever.
Before March of 2020, Madison nurse Shamaria Russell was working in a psychiatric ward. The first big change happened for her shortly after the coronavirus pandemic hit Wisconsin, when she was transferred to a general care unit.
Pretty much nurses were pulled from everywhere. It didn't matter what your specialty was or whether you had a lot of experience.
Now she primarily treats COVID patients. She says the pandemic has brought a lot of lasting changes in healthcare, like telehealth. But the biggest effect she's seen for healthcare workers is burnout and other mental health issues.
The nurses who have been working in the thick of everything the last 2 years, we really got to be aware that their mental health may be destroyed at some point.
According to a 2021 survey by the Kaiser Family Foundation, 62% of frontline healthcare workers say COVID-related stress has had a negative impact on their mental health. Russell says when treating COVID patients, it's difficult to mentally separate from work at the end of the day.
We're always sitting here thinking like, oh my God, did this person make it through the night? You know what I mean? Like, it's just, especially if the patient is really, really sick. And you know, carrying that type of weight around is mentally exhausting.
She says she's worried that a generation of healthcare workers will suffer because of what they've been through in the pandemic. UW-Madison School of Nursing clinical professor Sarah Endicott shares Russell's concern. She teaches a nursing theory class for nurses who are advancing their careers.
Which is typically a pretty straightforward, I don't want to say boring, but it's not usually everyone's favorite class. And the emotion that was coming out of students in a place where they could talk about what was happening to them.
She says dealing with people who are not taking measures to slow the virus's spread, like getting vaccinated, can be frustrating and hurtful.
The nurses who are witnessing what's really happening in the worst, the worst of the worst situations of the pandemic feel very isolated from their communities and from others who don't realize what they're going through.
One potential consequence of this mental toll is people leaving the healthcare field, says Wisconsin Hospital Association Senior Vice President Ann Zank. A new report from the association says registered nurse vacancies are at their highest level since 2005. Zank worries it's a threat to institutional knowledge.
Hospitals and health systems and their workforce have to work really hard to figure out, okay, how are we going to preserve the institutional knowledge? And also, how are we going to respond to a younger generation making up the majority of our workforce?
Patricia Tellez-Giron is a professor of family medicine at UW-Madison. She says they've been lucky to not lose any staff at the clinic where she practices.
But I think it was beautiful just to see how we all came together, you know, in the medical field and say, how can we help?
Still, it's been an exhausting 2 years, she says. And as far as what healthcare workers need most, well, she has some ideas.
We need a massage to start with. Now that maybe things are a little bit under control, right? To say, we really thank you for what you have done.
Beyond that, she says more flexibility, more time with patients, and better pay would help ensure Wisconsin's healthcare future. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now we're discussing the complex interplay of neuroscience and our brain's wiring that takes signals from the physical world around us and translates them into these useful thoughts and words that help us make decisions. What do you wonder about how the brain interprets different objects and sensations or words? Does a loved one have Parkinson's or dementia, maybe had a stroke? What do you want to know about how the brain works in neurological conditions? 800-642-1234. Leonardo Fernandino is a cognitive neuroscientist and assistant professor of neurology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Leonardo, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate.
Well, take us on a tour first of the brain through cognitive neurology. Acquaint us with what you study and why you're studying it.
Well, neuroscience is a very large and diverse field. Mm. My brand of neuroscience is called cognitive neuroscience, and that's the area that tries to understand mental processes, things that cognitive psychologists have been studying in terms of biology, in terms of how they're implemented in brain and neural circuits and these kinds of things. So our studies have to do with language comprehension, with memory, retrieving memories, how thinking and thought processes in general happen in terms of neurological processes.
And this is happening in the hippocampus region. Is that right? That's that location of our brain involving memory and learning. What are you finding out about how this area of the brain, you know, organizes and stores our memories, our knowledge that we're taking in from the world we live in?
Right. So the hippocampus is a little structure located in this area in the brain called the temporal lobe that is right behind your ears. And it's very important for a particular kind of memory that we call declarative memory or episodic memory. And what the hippocampus does is still, you know, a large area of research, and there are ideas about it, but we're still a long ways to from figuring it out exactly. But we know, for instance, that patients who have a stroke or if they have, say, carbon monoxide poisoning and damage the hippocampus in both sides of the in both hemispheres, because we have, you know, one in each hemisphere of the brain. So if you lesion both hippocampi, they become unable to form new long-term memories.
Hmm.
So they can still remember things for seconds or minutes, and they can have a conversation with you and you wouldn't notice there's anything wrong with them. But if you leave the room for a minute or two and then you come back, this person will not remember having ever met you. And you can actually have the same conversation with them and they won't recall having that conversation before. So this is called episodic memory, this memory for things that you have experienced, people you have met, events that you have participated in, say your last birthday party or why you parked your car this morning. And these kinds of memories, they rely critically on the hippocampus to be transformed into long-term memories and stay there in the long term.
And there must be so many, you know, you can't even count how many of these nuanced little memories that the brain is building up. And I just came across that new cognitive research that finds older adults trying to recall information that it's difficult and they have a harder time doing it than younger people. And the researchers may think that's because that older brain has a lot of clutter in there, like too much knowledge acquired years ago that may or may not be pertinent right now. What do you think about this idea of this clutter that could impair an older person's ability to recall things?
Mm-hmm. I've heard of this study. I haven't actually read the study, but I heard of it. And to me, it just intuitively, it makes sense. You know, long-term memories, they accumulate over time. You have many more episodic memories, and you know many more things about the world now than you did when you were 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's debatable, like, what is the total storage capacity of the brain? does it have a capacity limit? But we probably do have a limit in terms of how you can differentiate the ideas that you have stored. say if you're looking for a file in a file cabinet, your power to identify the right file will probably depends on how many of those files you have to go through, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the circuits that retrieve the memories that are stored based on your current needs, that may become more challenging the more memory engrams or the more memory traces, as people say, you have stored there to search through.
Cognitive neuroscientist Leonardo Fernandino, our guide to how the brain works, word associations, the sensory world, what is building up in the hippocampus region in memories. What fascinates you about brain decoding? What questions do you have about the brain's wiring that allow us to understand words and text? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Leonardo Fernandino here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing patterns of brain activity and how we form words on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So it's impossible not to mention the viral word puzzle game Wordle. Do you play it each day? Do you think puzzles exercise your brain and strengthen cognitive connections? Join in 800-642-1234. Medical College of Wisconsin Assistant Professor of Neurology Leonardo Fernandino is with us on Brain Function for the hour. Leonardo, you recently had a study published in the journal Proceedings of the Natural Academy of Sciences and looking at understanding how thoughts relate to the physical world that we experience through our senses. What did you find out there?
Yeah, so in that study, we used functional magnetic resonance imaging, which is a technique that allows us to record brain activity throughout the whole brain while our participants are doing some kind of mental task. And the task we asked them to do was to read words on the screen, one word at a time, and think about the meaning of that word. And from the brain activity we recorded, we were able to create an activation map throughout the brain for each individual word corresponding to the different meanings that the different words had. They had different patterns of activity throughout the brain. And so our question was, what kind of information is stored in these activation patterns? So traditionally, when we think of concepts, we have concepts for things like dogs, trees, houses, people, and so on. And these are thoughts, these have been traditionally thought as categories. So when you see a new dog that you've never seen before, you recognize it as a dog, mm-hmm. because you recognize it as a member of a category that you already know, the category of dogs. And then you can infer about that new dog many things that you already know about the category, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of conceptual thinking is very important, very central to our cognition. And one idea is that the meaning of the words, or the concepts that the words refer to, could be stored in the brain primarily in terms of these categories, the categories that they belong to. Another idea was that instead of the category that the word belongs to, the concept belongs to, maybe the brain stores the sensory, motor, experiential information experiences that you have as you live through the world, as you interact with the world. So when you see a dog, you see a certain kind of shape, a certain kind of, you know, profile, outlook. You see a certain kind of texture that is furry. You see certain kinds of shapes in the, you know, the ears and the tail, and they have a certain kind of noise associated with them, with the different kinds of barks. And maybe your concept of dog is represented and stored in the brain,
mm-hmm.
as a bundle of all of these different sensory motor experiential features.
So
and
here,
also say, uh-huh.
Oh, I just want to jump in. What if a research subject wouldn't know the word or wouldn't recognize a word you gave them? What happens then in the brain?
That's a really good question. So it is a task that it's often used in this kind of research is to present words that are very common and that everybody knows. And we also present fake words things like the sequence of letters COVLE, COVL. it's not a word, but it could be, right? It sounds like an English word, but it has no meaning. And so that way we make sure that none of our participants knows what that means. And then we can compare how the brain activity looks when you see a word that has meaning compared to something that is just like a word, but it has no meaning.
My brain instantly said, oh, COVID, you have a typo there. It's COVID.
Right. Yes, because your brain is conditioned.
Yes. Carry on. Keep going.
Yeah. So with this kind of analysis, this kind of experimental paradigm, we can tell which areas are particularly important for processing the meaning of words, as opposed to the letters that make up the word or the sounds that make up the word or, you know, the syllables, because this fake word has all of that. The only thing that it is missing is the meaning. And so this is a technique generally called cognitive subtraction. You present two experimental conditions that differ only in terms of one aspect. In this case, it's the semantics of the word. And then whatever activates more for one than the other, you can tell that it's due to that factor. Mm. And so we can see areas of the brain that are particularly important for storing or retrieving the meaning of the word as opposed to other things about the word.
What if you didn't have this functional resonance imaging? I mean, is this like an MRI?
Yes, it's the same equipment that you use for a regular MRI, if you do like a knee MRI or a shoulder MRI, but it has some extra equipment inside it that allows us to make a picture of the whole brain very fast in just a second or two. You take a picture of the whole brain in very high resolution such that each voxel, which is basically a three-dimensional pixel, is 2 millimeters by 2 millimeters by 2 millimeters. So that's very high resolution. And we tune the scanner so that the signal depends primarily on how much oxygenated blood there is in that point in the brain. Hmm. And it turns out that when your brain becomes more active, when a certain part of your brain becomes more active, it consumes more glucose and more oxygen. And so that leads the blood vessels there to expand and bring more oxygenated blood to that area. Hmm. So the level of oxygenated blood compared to deoxygenated blood increases, and so that area becomes brighter on the functional MRI image. So this is an indirect measure of how active the neurons in that point in the brain are.
Talking with Leonardo Fernandino, assistant professor of neurology at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and his work focuses on how the mind processes different types of information. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Gary is joining us from Appleton. Hi, Gary. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you today?
Doing well. We can kind of barely hear you, so we'll give it a shot. Go ahead.
Okay, I do poetry with people living with dementia, and we use call and response to perform poems. So we tap into a type of memory called echoic memory. And I wanted to know, are you hearing me okay?
We can still hear you, yes. Uh-huh. Call and response poems, yes.
Okay, so echoic memory is the type of memory that you might used to, say, hold a phone number in your mind long enough to dial it, and it's about 4 to 8 seconds long, so we say a line of poetry and the group or person says it back to us, and what we find is, anecdotally, we see a brightening affect, and I think that my theory is that it's increasing the blood flow in certain parts of the brain when we're doing this, and that's why we see such positive results, and I wondered if our neurologist would like to comment on that.
Gary, thank you so much for that. Leonardo, go ahead.
So I couldn't hear him very well, but I think he said that he works with people with dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
He reads poetry to them.
Yes, this call and response poetry, and wondering if that opens up some pathways there as you go through those types of functions. Is it echoic memory? Is that it?
Yes, that's part of it, certainly, is the echoic memory is the memory for recently listened to sounds.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
It has to do with, you know, your auditory system, the lingering activity that stays there after the sound ends. But it probably has to do with more than that as well. It probably has to do with your ability to decode those speech sounds and transfer them into meaning. And then to recall, I assume that in this procedure, the person knows the line that's supposed to come after.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they have to retrieve this long-term memory based on that line that they just heard that works as a cue. And so it exercises this memory retrieval mechanism
in the brain. Let's pause there with cognitive neuroscientist Leonardo Fernandino. Studies how the brain enables the mind. We'll pick this up after a news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring the inner workings of our brains with a cognitive neuroscientist on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers studying how language and speech is processed in the brain and how to best rehabilitate people who have lost their ability to communicate due to a brain damage caused by a stroke, perhaps. Do you have aphasia, damage to the part of the brain that is responsible for language production and processing? What has your physician told you about rehabilitation? 800-642-1234 to join in. Cognitive neuroscientist Leonardo Fernandino of the Medical College of Wisconsin is with us for the hour. Let's bring on Bill now, calling us from the North Woods. Hi, Bill. What would you like to bring up?
Oh, hello. Phenomenal topic there. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everyone.
You too.
And I have just a couple few questions. Is one of them if he's done any research or studies in regards to sometimes when the patients have some direct families that are dealing with issues with strokes and different things, and that when you sing sometimes to the patients that you can kind of reel the person's thought process back in. And then also if he's done anything in regards to the overload of aluminum intake into the brain on with the synapse and how it kind of tarnishes it. And also has he done anything on how caffeine might stimulate the brain cells with individuals that are older? And thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill. Several different areas there. Perhaps starting with singing to patients, what impact might that have on a stroke patient, Leonardo?
That's a tough question.
Hmm.
I don't have any direct experience with singing therapies mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. patients. I have heard about studies on how music can have positive impacts on people with dementia.
But how might your work in mapping what parts of the brain respond to certain words or concepts, how might that lead to better understanding rehabilitation techniques for, say, a stroke patient?
Right. So depending on the type of stroke the person has, like what parts of the brain are damaged, they can lose the ability to recognize certain kinds of things, say, birds or animals or tools, and while keeping other kinds of concepts preserved. And so it's a deficit in the conceptual system, not so much in the speech system, but in the knowledge system. And these patients, unfortunately, they largely go untreated because we don't understand how the conceptual system works in the brain, so we don't know how to fix it. So my research studies healthy individuals and studying the conceptual system and trying to deconstruct and finding what's the machinery going on in the healthy brain that allows us to be able to work with concepts and retrieve the concepts that we need and recognize objects and understand the meaning of words, so that once we understand the machinery, we'll be able to use that information to try and fix it when it's broken.
And that would then translate into certain types of therapies that might help that patient regain the word connections, word associations, or, you know, things like that.
Exactly. So if we can understand what is the kind of information that is stored in the part of the brain that was damaged, or what kind of information processing goes on in that area. Well, unfortunately, the central nervous system, that is the brain and the spinal cord, they don't heal well. Once you have a lesion or damage there, they just stay damaged. And so the best that we can do at this point is to have the person practice the skills that were lost as much as possible, so that areas of the brain around that area that are still intact can learn how to do what the affected area used to do. But the challenge is, so how do you give the patient these rehabilitation training if you don't know what is the information that you're supposed to make up for? Mm-hmm. So that's where this research comes in. Once we know what is the kinds of information and a kind of processing that was damaged that led to that symptom, to that syndrome, then we can develop specific rehabilitation procedures for that.
I want to pick up on that word practice, doing something over and over and over again. What does that do for the brain in terms of, basically from your biological standpoint, when you say, you know, you're going to practice something over and over?
Mm-hmm. So whenever the brain does perform some task, you have these nerve cells, the neurons, sending signals to each other, electrical signals to each other. And information is stored in the connections between these neurons. Neurons that communicate with each other, they can either strengthen these connections so that they communicate more easily, or they can send a stronger communication signal, or they can decrease that and make that quieter, depending on whether that helps you achieve your goal. And so when you practice something, you're basically allowing your brain to process this information and send these signals, and then determine whether that was successful or not. Mm-hmm. And when it was successful, then the paths that were used become reinforced, and the paths that were not used become, they become weakened. And whenever you try it and you don't succeed, then you de-emphasize those pathways.
I didn't mean to budge in there. I was just going to reintroduce you here. Leonardo Fernandino, assistant professor of neurology at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and talking about brain science, how the mind processes different kinds of information. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Carol in Milwaukee called in with a question, is wondering, Leonardo, what people can do to improve their immediate memory, their immediate recall, and prevent that short-term memory loss?
That's a tough question. If that's something that people have been working on for a while, and results have been controversial. There have been groups that claim that if you do some kinds of brain training tasks, that like some computerized games that are designed to be designed to train, to work out these short-term memory and processing aspects of the brain that lead to an improvement over time. It turns out that further research showed that you do become better at those games, but you don't become better in anything else besides those games. So how good is that? So there's still an open question whether, to what extent we can actually train these systems so that they become good in general, so that you, just like if you go to the gym and you work out your muscles, you become stronger for whatever else you want to do, right? Not just for lifting weights.
Yeah, I think our brain can trick us in that one. Say, yeah, we'll get good at this game, but, you know, we're still going to slack off in all of these other areas where you really want us to be good as well.
Exactly.
Let's go to Chris now in Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Chris. What's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question. I have a daughter, beautiful woman. When she was young, she was bright, she was beautiful, intelligent. She was molested at one point. She is now in her 50s. She has DID, a dissociative personality disorder. And back when we had lots of money, we took her to the best specialists in the country. She knew as much or more than they about the brain and medications. She studied, but 50% of the time, one day she'll be wonderful, giving me, helping me, just a marvelous human being. And one word can flip, and then she is mean, manipulating, nasty, and the next day she won't remember that disassociation.
Interesting.
Has any work been done on this?
Thank you, Chris, for that. Leonardo, go ahead.
Well, first of all, I'm sorry to hear about what happened to your daughter, but unfortunately, I don't know of any research in this area. It sounds like there should be a lot of research. Unfortunately, I'm not aware of any studies in that area.
When it comes to dementia and memory, how is research in cognitive neurology addressing dementia and memory loss? Because when I think about you studying and imaging a healthy brain, I'm really interested to see whether you scan a brain that is unhealthy or a brain that is suffering and whether you can actually see that on your high-resolution scanning.
It really depends on what is the infirmity, what is the problem going on in the brain.
Okay.
For some things, for instance, someone who is depressed or someone who has, say, some mild form of bipolar disorder or psychiatric disorders. Typically, when you image the brain, if you just look at the structure of the brain, the anatomy of the brain, they look identical.
Okay.
And if you do functional MRI and you give them the regular kinds of cognitive tasks that we give, by and large, they also look the same. Like, you can't tell whether someone has schizophrenia or not, or whether they are depressed or not, just based on functional brain imaging. It's mm-hmm. something that people have been looking at, because it would be helpful if we could diagnose or at least help diagnose mental disorders based on something very objective, such as brain activity. Mm-hmm. But at this point, it doesn't seem to be the case at all, because brain activity patterns, they vary a lot from person to person, both in healthy people and people who have some kind of infirmity. And so it's very difficult to tell healthy from unhealthy just based on that.
Medical College of Wisconsin Assistant Professor of Neurology Leonardo Fernandino with us, stays with us on how the brain enables the mind. What do you want to know about brain science and the functions of a brain in decoding the words and the world around us? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about brain science on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Every time we learn or do something new, our brain makes a new connection. Brain plasticity allows us to learn new skills, gather and use new information, recover from brain injuries. What do you hope scientists discover about the brain? What aspects of the brain do you study? Still time to talk, noting it is Brain Awareness Week, 800-642-1234. Medical College of Wisconsin Assistant Professor of Neurology Leonardo Fernandino stays with us for about 10 more minutes. We did have a call here earlier about from Connie on dyslexia, Leonardo, and wondering what happens in the brain with dyslexia and what can you learn about it through imaging?
That's a great question. And it's something that is being heavily investigated. And what we know at this point is that there seem to be some differences in the brains of children with dyslexia related to the areas that transform the visual information about the letters into the sounds of the word. And so it seems like there is a deficit in this path that connects the visual shape of the word to the sound form of the word, which we call the phonological word. And we still don't know why that is, why someone has is born with dyslexia as opposed to not. But that seems to be where the problem lies.
You also work on how minds interpret the physical world with, you know, what's happening in the brain when someone has lost a limb and can still feel it, that phantom limbs. What is research looking into there? What are you finding?
Our group in particular, we haven't worked with phantom limb patients, but phantom limb is what happens when someone has a limb amputated, mm-hmm. and then after they heal, they can still feel, experience that limb as if it was there. So if they lose, say, a leg below the knee, they can still feel their calf and their foot and their heel and their toes, and often they feel pain in these parts of the brain that they don't have anymore. And it's a really terrible thing because it's a pain that you can't really touch and you can't, you know, massage your leg. There's nothing you can do about it because the pain comes directly from your brain. It's because your brain has still a representation of that leg or that limb that was lost.
Mm-hmm.
In the healthy brain, we can see that, for instance, with functional MRI, when you touch different parts of the body, different parts of this strip of cortex called the sensory motor cortex, they get activated because they map each portion of the somatosensory cortex is mapped to a different part of the brain, and so to a different part of the body. And so when you touch that part of the body, when the person moves that part of the body, that particular area in the brain gets activated. When you lose the limb, that part of the brain is still there, but now it doesn't have any inputs from the limb that was lost. So the areas around it start invading it and sending in neural projections, and that area starts responding to stimuli to other parts of the brain. But your brain still thinks that the stimulus is coming from that limb that is not there anymore. So one really interesting study that a neuroscientist from University of California, San Diego has done, Dr. Ramachandran, was to find out that for someone who has phantom limb pain in a hand that they missed, they feel like the phantom hand is gripping and closed so tight that it hurts. But if they put the healthy hand into a box that has mirrors on the side and put their phantom hand, they pretend to put the phantom hand on the other side of the box, now when they look through the mirror, they see a mirror reflection of the real hand that is exactly where the phantom hand would be.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they open the healthy hand, then they feel the phantom hand opening as well, and the pain goes away.
Wow.
So basically, you use your vision to trick your brain.
You're tricking your brain. Yes.
Yeah.
Wow. We had a listener who emailed with a question about chemotherapy treatments and the impact on the brain and the brain fog, and is wondering if you have any insights on brain fog and chemotherapy treatments.
Unfortunately, that's not something I know much about.
Mm-hmm.
This is a more clinical area, and I am primarily a basic research scientist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't see patients, for instance, so I'm afraid I don't have much to say about that.
And along those lines as well, I'm sure you're watching, you know, as these cases of COVID are making a mark on the brain and affecting the brain, you know, symptoms of COVID also triggering some type of brain fog.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'm sure there are so many mysteries around issues like that connecting disease with what is happening in the brain.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a fascinating and scary topic, how all the different ways in which the brain can be affected by virus and bacteria and substances and environmental factors, all the different ways that they can impact the brain in the short term and in the long term. So there is still a long way to go for us to be able to understand those things as well as we understand, say, heart disease or liver disease.
What can we do today, Leonardo? What is the best way to help people maintain mental vitality and brain health?
Well, one main thing is to maintain physical fitness, physical health. Everything that is good for your cardiovascular system is good for the brain because the brain is very heavily vascularized. It consumes a lot of energy, and the brain cells, they need to receive blood constantly. They can't go for a long time without receiving oxygen. They die. And so a lot of the pathologies that we have in the brain are due to restricted blood flow to those areas of the brain. Stroke, for instance, is when the blood flow stops and then those cells die, or they almost die, but then they can recover depending on how long the blockage happens. And so one thing that can surely help your brain is to do the things that are good for your heart. So keep your good physical fitness, don't eat too much triglycerides or saturated fat, things that lead to atherosclerosis. So have a healthy diet and exercise. Don't stay sitting all day.
So as we start to wrap up, Leonardo, what is next for your research? Where do you take it from here?
So we are pursuing now, building on top of the work we have already done, new studies to try to find out in more detail the kind of information that the brain uses in processing word meaning, in processing concept in general. So we are going to try to do similar studies that we have done, but with a few variations that will allow us to test new computational models that how this information is put together.
And
I won't try to explain that in detail here.
But we follow along, I think, generally. And how do scientists like yourself are collaborating on this cognitive neuroscience? I would imagine a lot of people are trying to understand what's happening with word association.
Absolutely, yeah. There are several groups all over the world working on this, and we are always in contact through conferences. We meet at a couple times a year in conferences. The last 2 years we haven't because of COVID, but now with April I'll have my first in-person conference after COVID, and so I'll get to see people from all over the world who work on this, and then we share our results and we comment on each other. And we stay in touch via, Twitter, and emailing each other's papers. And occasionally we do joint experiments with another group where we can collect data together. Collect some data here, they collect some data there.
Sure.
We collaborate in the analysis.
Well, Leonardo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Leonardo Fernandino, assistant professor of neurology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. For disclosure, Medical College of Wisconsin is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. I hope you meet us back here tomorrow from 7 to 9. We've got the Wisconsin Poet Laureate and so much more. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.